So, could you tell us about where and when you were born?
I was born in Van Wert, Ohio. It's a little small town in northwest Ohio in 1953.
And what were your parents' names?
Wayne Garris and Phyllis Garris.
Do you have any brothers and sisters?
I had three brothers, one who is deceased, two that are still alive.
What is your earliest memory?
Of being here in Dayton or of anything?
Just as a child, one of your earliest memories.
Oh, well, you know, the earliest memories were always traumatic experiences. Kindergarten, back before they had paper cartons for milk, when it was just, it was always in little glass bottles. Running in kindergarten when I wasn't supposed to run during milk break, and tripping and falling and smashing glass and milk everywhere. So that's my earliest memory. It's gotten better since then.
Do you remember your grandparents? Could you tell us a little bit about them?
Oh, yeah, I remember my grandparents, yeah. There's a lot of longevity. My grandfather lived to be 96, and his wife lived to be like 88 or 89. So I remember them very well. And really on both sides of my family, my grandparents made it into the late 60s or the early 80s. So yeah, I remember them very well.
Were there any stories in particular that your grandparents used to tell you that you remember or have stuck with you?
Yeah, they grew up on farms. They all grew up on farms. My grandfather on my father's side, he was born in 1884, and he had vivid memories of freed slaves who had come up after the Civil War and had farms close to where their farm was. And I can remember him telling stories of him as a young child hearing stories about slavery. And that's something that, you know, I always remember my grandpa telling me. And on my mother's side, they were the very socially active side, and they were big socialists. So they were always talking about Eugene Debs, you know, who was the firebrand socialist guy that ran for president in prison when he was in prison. So those are stories that I do remember from my grandparents.
Do you have a best memory or a favorite memory from growing up as a child?
As a child or college? Child?
As a child. We'll get to college.
Yeah, I guess one of my favorite memories is junior year when I was decorations chairman for the junior-senior prom. And whereas prom was a complete bust for me, it was a bad experience. And at my 45th high school reunion, I apologized to my date publicly for making her a miserable prom date. But the year or the week leading up to it, when we were out of school and we took over the gym and we got to decorate the gym, that was a wonderful week of running around, getting the paper, getting the wood, building this, building that. You know, that was just a real, well, we were probably 17 years old. You know, we had the whole world ahead of us, and it was just really fun. I have good memories of that week. Prom night, you know, because it was like you were so tired from doing all the work to get to that point when it was finally time to get dressed up and go to prom. You know, I'm just looking at, oh man, we should have done this or we should have done that. I think I danced once. I was a rotten date. But leading up to it, very fond memories.
Could you tell us about elementary school, high school, just growing up in those days, the community, the type of kids that you went to school with?
Well, Van Wert had probably 10, 12,000 people then. I think it's got 10, 12,000 people now. It was a pretty just normal Midwest Ohio county seat. I went to school with migrant kids who would come up and work the tomato fields, and then a number of them stayed. I grew up with African American kids. We were, everything was integrated in Van Wert because we were so small. It wasn't big enough to have separate but equal. And so, you know, everything you did, the swimming pool, you know, it wasn't whites and blacks and browns separated this way and that way. It was everybody together. So that was one of the things that kind of jarred me when I first came to Dayton, which was a big city, which did have a bunch of separate but equal places. It was kind of like my first experience with that when I came down here to go to law school. So, you know, it was kind of like you could ride your bike anywhere. You know, we had, quote, hoods who started smoking cigarettes when they were 14. We had some shoplifting gangs that would go in and shoplift 45 records. But, you know, it was pretty simple life. There was, you know, you could ride your bike anywhere and you could sit in the park all day long without getting accosted. I'm sure there were things that were going on beneath the surface that kids never found out about, but to me it was a pretty pretty idyllic life growing up. Yeah. And we were, my father was a factory worker, and my mom was a church secretary. So we were probably, if you were doing the economic classification, we were probably very low middle class. But I never knew that until I got older.
And do you have any memories of the arcade as a child, or once you came to Dayton?
My memories of the arcade started in 1981.
Right.
I went to the University of Dayton Law School from 1975 to 78, moved to Columbus where I was an assistant attorney general for a couple years. I started dating my wife when we were in law school together, and then it was like, okay, we're getting married, we're moving back, or I'm moving back. Me and three of my other buddies started our law firm together. So I moved back here in March of 81, and the arcade had just reopened by then. And one word to describe it is magnificent. It was one of the best places to be in the entire world. It was truly like walking from Kansas, black and white Kansas, into the land of Oz. It was a wonderful place. And then they ruined it.
How so? Could you elaborate?
I think it was bad management. I think it was bad management from the beginning. The arcade, you know, it had been closed for a number of years. And when they got the money together, and then when they reopened it, it had everything. It had stores, it had shops, it had trendy restaurants, it had an oyster raw bar, it had a top shelf seafood place up on the second floor, it had a smoke shop, it had a shop that just sold Irish related things, it had a Coca-Cola museum of all things, it had a bakery, it had was connected to a magnificent five and dime store. It just had everything that you needed. You didn't have to shop anywhere else. And there was always the hubbub of people coming in and out. If you wanted to find somebody in downtown Dayton, go to the arcade, and probably sometime during the day, you would see them walking through. And it was just beautiful. It was magnificent. It was, everything was going on at the arcade. I can't begin to tell you how wonderful it was. On the second floor, there was a they originally started in Columbus, and I think their second store was here in Dayton called the Emporium, and it was fancy cookware. They had cooking classes up there. You could buy biscotti from Italy. I mean, it was just a wonderful place. And then, as things like that tend to be, my belief is it was bad management. You know, they started having And I'm just assuming this. I'm just a young lawyer going over there every day at least once. There was not a day other than maybe on the weekend that I wasn't in the arcade. They had all these great restaurants, you know, Chinese place, everything. Smoke shop. I was a heavy smoker back then. I bought all my cigarettes there. They just had everything there. And They started having, control issues with people. There was a bus stop right out on 3rd Street that was right at the main door, the 3rd Street door that went into the arcade. And that was always a problem, congregation, young kids, things like that. And, you know, people are always looking for what's new, what's new, you know. After a while, a couple years, the arcade wasn't new. The kids were getting a little rowdier. There were places that, you know, they wanted the Coca-Cola Museum out of there. I'm not sure why, because that guy actually wanted more space. He was willing to rent more space, but they ran him out. And then stores started closing, and then all of a sudden it was like, bam, they closed. And it's like, okay, how'd that all happen? Well, then, you know, this, I don't know if it was bankruptcy or whatever, but, you know, public money that went in is now gone, and, you know, now they're going to reconfigure the whole thing. They're going to refinance the whole thing. I am not a real estate developer. I'm not a Donald Trump. I don't know how those guys do things like that and put it together, other than I think they're all the time stabbing each other in the back. That's just my theory behind it. When you look at all this kind of real estate stuff that goes on, I have absolutely no idea what went on with the arcade, why it ended up closing then, but it ended up closing. And then a new group came in. And when the new group came in, they had a different vision for it. And that's when they jackhammered the hole in the floor. The original arcade, if you look at old historical pictures of it, you can see that there's stores that are in the on the first floor that are in the center of the rotunda rather than just on the side. When they decided to reopen it, their brilliant idea was to jackhammer a hole in the floor. Why in God's name you would do that when you want people to, you know, look at this magnificent rotunda? Why would you jackhammer a hole in the floor and then move everything down? But that was the concept they came up with. I can remember standing with a gentleman by the name of Leo McGarry. Leo McGarry was a decorated World War II bomber pilot, escaped the Nazis for 5 or 6 weeks as they chased him across the European continent. And when he got out of the military, he eventually owned the grocery store in the arcade. And when the arcade first closed in the 70s, Leo started working here at Dayton Municipal Court and became head of the Violations Bureau. And so he had tremendously fond memories of the arcade from when he ran the grocery store. And I can remember standing there with Leo watching them jackhammer the floor. To put the hole in the floor, and he had tears coming out of his eyes. He said, "They're going to ruin the arcade. Why are they doing this?" And I think, you know, I think Leo is right, because now they're putting the floor back in. But that was when they started it again. That's when they renewed the arcade. And they had all the fast food places. They moved it downstairs. You'll eventually hear from my former law partner a case that had a lot to do with how things ended up going at the arcade. They did have people, businesses starting to come back. There was a law firm that was there. Wright Pack Credit Union had a small office. Then they had a bigger office. They wanted to expand. But once again, it was bad management. They got to the point where they quit fixing things. I can remember sitting in Ron Reichert's law office, and he actually wanted to rent more space. He was in the walkway, the part that comes from 3rd Street to the rotunda, up on the second floor. On one side, it was his law office. On the other side was Wright Pack Credit Union. They both wanted more space. When it rained outside, it rained in their offices. I can remember sitting there talking with him, and he had like seven waste paper cans set around in his office, getting the raindrops coming in. I was pretty good friends with a number of the fast food places in the basement, particularly the Zalakis brothers, who were Greek, who had the Euro place. And, you know, they were frustrated because it would flood down there. Management wouldn't do anything about it. The restrooms broke. Management wouldn't fix the restrooms. They just, you want to talk about benign neglect. Whoever was the management then, they went way over their head. They put no money into keeping the thing going. And so then it was just, and so, you know, when you do that, when you neglect something like that, then people go, well, that's it, we're not coming back. Why go to a place where you can't go to the restroom? Why go to the place where when it's raining outside, it's raining inside? So people quit coming. And then most importantly for it, the tenants quit paying the rent. You know, if you're not going to fix this, I'm going to quit paying rent. So tenants quit paying rent. And then it was just a matter of time until they finally closed. I think they closed in January of 91, I believe. And in January of 91, I was already elected a judge by then. I can remember standing out in front of the arcade holding up a sign that said, "Close Danis, not the arcade." Tom Danis was the guy who stepped forward with the money and bought the arcade for $265,000, something like that.
Nothing, yeah.
Yeah, it was a very low amount of money. And so for years, I held a grudge against him, and this is one of my public apologies that I'm going to give you now. I blamed him for, you know, the arcade not getting reopened, for not doing it, because he, like, started evicting everybody. And then it would only be open, like, for a day or two getting up to the holidays. They would decorate the rotunda, and you could come in for, like, 2 days, but then it would be closed again. And within about the past year, I've been informed by one of the then city officials who knew what was going on that Tom Danis had actually bought the arcade as a favor to the city of Dayton. City manager at the time, a guy named Rick Helwig, to buy it, to mothball it, to keep it from being torn down. So for 20 years, I've been running down Tom Danis, and for 20 years I got to apologize, because he's actually probably the guy whose money kept it shuttered, kept it mothballed, and he paid the price for it too, because it cost his family so much, the family business so much, to keep it mothballed, that some of his brothers and sisters in the family business reacted and voted him out of running the place. So he wasn't in charge of Danis Industries for a number of years. He finally got control back. But I think he's, if my sources at City Hall tell me straight, and I think they are, I think he's going to end up being one of the unsung heroes of any reopening of the arcade, that he was the guy that stepped forward for the city and bought it and mothballed it and kept it for the next generation. So that's my public apology to Tom Danis.
Wow. And could you tell us about some of the immediate effects that you saw because of the arcade closing in the community here in Dayton?
Yeah, you know, the arcade is, it's not the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. It's not like an albatross around the city's neck, but in some senses it is. People love the rotunda. But the arcade is this hodgepodge of all these other buildings. And that's always been the albatross, if you will, around the rotunda's neck. When people think of the arcade, they think of the glass rotunda, the turkeys, all the wonderful things that were there. They don't think of the buildings that are around there, the apartments that are around there, the other things that make up the arcade. You can't have the rotunda without all the other buildings. People, and I understand this from being an elected official, people on the east side of Dayton, which has always primarily been Appalachian white, always say, well, all the money goes to downtown. People on the west side of Dayton, which has primarily lately been African American, say all the money always goes to downtown. So the arcade has always been the common point of anger on both sides of the city, that everything goes to the arcade. As an elected official, I've heard that repeatedly in the late 80s. I got elected judge in 87, started in 88. From 88 till 91, when they closed, it was constantly, well, you know, the city just puts all that money in the arcade. And that didn't matter what side of town you were on. You heard it on both sides of town. The arcade gets this, the arcade gets that. They never do anything for the neighborhoods. So then, of course, when the arcade closes, you know, the money's still not going east or west like people feel it should be that are in the neighborhoods. And so every time somebody would talk about reopening the arcade, trying to get it going again, you would hear that drumbeat again on both sides of town about, yeah, oh, there you go. Everybody's got to put all their money in the arcade. And unfortunately, you know, people as they get older, you'll find this, you guys are all young now, but when you get older, you sometimes get nostalgic for the old days. And it's very easy to remember things differently than they really happened. And a lot of people who grew up in Dayton, who loved the arcade, who shopped there in the 60s and 70s before it closed the first time, they don't live in Dayton. They live in the suburbs. And so they're the ones that always, well, open the arcade. Well, you don't live in the neighborhood that's infested with crime. You live out in warm and cheerful Centerville, and you want the city of Dayton to put all this money into fixing the arcade. Well, why don't you put some money into fixing the arcade? So there's always been that going on. I can honestly say I can't think of a more divisive issue in downtown than the arcade. It has just, for my time being here involved with politics and government since 1981 on, I can't think of a thing that's been more controversial, more steeped in intrigue, more false starts, more on again, off again, more anger, more being a lightning rod for society's ills than the arcade. I truly hope this time it works. I hope it works for a long time, because it is, it's really, when it was up and running, it was a magical place.
So going back to some of the great shops that you visited at the arcade and saw, could you walk us through maybe just a typical day as a visitor of the arcade, as a shopper?
Oh, sure.
Some of the things you would see.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you could go to the arcade. You could get your coffee and donuts. There was a bakery shop. You could go to McCroy's, which was one of the best five and dime stores ever. You could buy a parakeet, you could buy goldfish, you could buy fresh roasted peanuts. They had a lunch counter where you could get a cheeseburger. You could buy bolts of cloth. You could buy shoelaces, car wax, house paint. You could get whatever you needed at McCroy's. It was a two-story operation. They had a first floor and a basement. Mm-hmm. So if you were running short of something at the office, like paper clips or whatever, you could run over to McCroy's and get it. The smoke shop, I told you I was a heavy smoker back then. You know, you could get cigars from all over the world, your cigarettes, you could get pipe tobacco there. If you were taking somebody out for a nice evening, you would go to Charlie's, which was the fancy fish Charlie's restaurant.
Crab.
Yeah. You could go to the Raw Bar, which was on the first floor. They had a men's clothing store. Men's or women's clothing? I think they had both, a men's and women's clothing store. They had the Emporium, the
fish
upstairs.
Store, not Crab, Charlie's Crab, but the other fish store.
Yeah,
where,
oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where they sold
seafood.
The wholesale fish.
Yeah, they had Arcade Seafood,
yeah.
Which was actually one of the last businesses in the arcade. It continued to operate even after they closed it, because it had its own entrance. And Seafood Arcade was there probably well into the 2000s, probably into the 2008s or 9. Seafood Arcade, and you go in there and there's the full fish from all over the world, so that was quite a popular place. I forgot all about the Arcade Seafood. Yeah, so you could get whatever you wanted there, and it was just a great place.
And was it a good mix of people? So family, younger people, high schoolers.
I would be there during the workday. On the weekends, it really wasn't a destination for people to come on the weekends. When my parents would come in from out of town, we would go down there on the weekends. But I think their weekend business was pretty slow. I know every time I was down there on a weekend, unless it would be like the holiday times, it would be pretty slow. But during the day, yeah, I mean, everybody ate at the arcade. We ate at the arcade 3-4 times a week. Like I said earlier, if you wanted to find somebody in Dayton, you would run into them at the arcade. I mean, a lot of tips were given to reporters at the arcade over in the corner. There would always be a little intrigue going on, politically. It was a great meeting place. It really was. And I will say one thing that was nice about the hole getting cut in the floor. You could stand at the rail and look down and mm-hmm. figure out who's talking to who. So you were like, oh man, Joe's talking to Bill, something's up. So, that's one thing that the hole in the floor did give you the opportunity for, was to spy on what was going on. But I do think they need to put the floor back.
Yeah, touching upon that, what are some of the things you'd like to see return to the arcade or for this new development plan to include? Or what do you think it's going to take to make the arcade successful again?
One of the things it's going to take to make the arcade successful is something that they've never really been able to get a handle on. And my friend Dennis is going to be able to help you on this one. Is making people feel safe. And that's always been a problem with anything downtown, is making people feel safe. And, it's just a fact that older people, black or white, younger people make them nervous. And, with all the buses of school-age teens that come through Dayton, really, it's just going to be across the street at the bus stop. It makes older people nervous. It did back then, and it's going to in the future. And the arcade always struggled with trying to make people feel safe. And downtown struggles with trying to make people feel safe. Now, I've been a judge in this town for 31 years. I can tell you that downtown Dayton's a pretty safe place to be. Because I see the crime reports, I deal with them every day. Downtown Dayton's a pretty safe place to be, but trying to convince people of that. And that's going to be something that the arcade is really going to have to work on. I hope they take some lessons from our friends that run the Dayton Triangles. Because the Dayton Triangles, the Dayton Dragons, excuse me, I'm getting football and baseball mixed up. The Dayton Dragons are celebrating their 20th year. And a lot of people said, they'll build that stadium and nobody will come down because people will be afraid of coming to downtown Dayton. Well, for 20 years, every game has been sold out. People feel safe coming down at night to downtown Dayton to go to the Dayton Dragons games, and they have a good system of ensuring people's safety and making people feel safe coming and going from the Dragons games. The management, Bob Murphy and those guys that run the Dayton Dragons, have done a tremendous job with that, with off-duty police officers inside and outside. The city of Dayton has, their patrols over there. And really, there's in the 20 years, there's been minimal problems of people feeling safe there. So that's going to be one thing key for the arcade, is to make people feel safe. The Oregon District, they, from time to time, they struggle with, muggings or whatever going on. You got to make people feel safe. And the way you do that is by having visible either law enforcement or security. And I think, the arcade's going to need to do that. They're going to need to make people feel, when they come down here and go to the arcade, that they won't have any problem getting there and they won't have any problem leaving.
Okay, thank you, Judge.
Now, you need his story.
Yes.
Yeah, because his is the good story. The Harry Weiner story. Well, because it has a lot to do with how they
it does.
How they did